You're listening to Marcus Sahaba Online Radio Podcast.
This is, yes, the program is Wasail and Elam Asadika. Yes, Professor Andre Duvanaga is with us this evening. Let me welcome Pais and Sagacious Ummah with a hearty Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And yes, you are joined, and we are joined by our favorite Professor Andre Duvanaga. And I'm looking at his composite, which says, Professor Andre Duvanaga discusses looking at the graph of a nation 28 years old still playing the blame game. And Professor Andre Duvanaga is in the University of Potchefstroom there in the Northwest. He's also in senior management. He lectures in political science and is also well sought of by media houses around the world. Prof, it's so great to have you on Wasail al-Elam al-Sadika, you know, a program that goes around the world, and it has our podcast, which is called up every 5-10 minutes from people around the world wanting to listen to this segment or to this show. And I'm so glad that you've made your time to be with us. And who better than you, Professor Andre Duvanaga, to look at the scenario of a country that, you know, someone looked up to, you know, because of Madiba making it an iconic country. Then you had people like Jan Smuts here, and the history is so rich with you know, Cecil John Rhodes, and then you get the Beers, and as you move forward, you find that, yes, after apartheid, Madiba comes through, get the Mbekis, and then you get the Zumas coming through, now the Cyril Ramaphosa. But, Prof, when you look at a house, when you build a house, you build a foundation, then you put up the bricks, and then you put up the structures, and then you put your roof up, and, you know, your ceilings, everything's done. But if you can't build a house 28 years, and you still start blaming, you know what, that man that sold me the land, oh no, he didn't give me this, he didn't give me that. But everything was at your disposal. You got the gold, you got the uranium, you got the platinum, you got the diamonds, you got, now you're finding oil and you're finding gas, and you got basically everything, but you're still blaming someone else for your short call or for your shortcoming. Prof, I want you to, you know, get this mindset firstly, teach us about the mindset, and secondly, the blame game. I mean, if you look at people like the Indians, for India, for instance, they can tell you, well, the British has looted us and they took our economy away from us and they did this to us. No, we can't make it. This is why we pay. But look at them. They came back powerful. They're there. And, you know, many people that were under the colonists or that were colonized, or many countries that were under the colonists broke away and made successes of themselves. Look at Malaysia. Look at Indonesia. Look at all these other countries that were colonized once upon a time. But today they are success stories. But South Africa seems, the South African people in general seem to have a chip on the shoulder. How would you react to that, Professor Andre Duvanaga?
Yes, Shafat, indeed, you are quite right. In South Africa, we are playing the blame game. We are blaming apartheid. We are blaming colonialism. We are sometimes more focused on the past than we are focused on the future. And by saying that, I think the examples you are using, like India, like Malaysia, and there are so many others, the most interesting one you didn't mention is the United States of America, probably the strongest superpower in the world today, who was also a British colony. Now, South Africa, 28 years after, in inverted commas, independence, we are still fighting the blaming game and still do the blame thing on apartheid. If something is getting wrong, they blame history. And the fact of the matter is, we are not going forward. And at the moment, we are still thriving on the agenda of the history. And I am concerned about the fact that there's a complete lack of strategic vision in terms of our leadership. They do not have a strategic viewpoint. What is happening, the ANC as a freedom movement, basically reacting on colonization. And they still believe they are a freedom movement, even if they are in charge of a democratic government. Bringing me to the point of democratization. We are a new democracy, but at the moment, our democracy is facing probably the biggest challenges since 1994. And if you want to, we can talk about some of these challenges in terms of the institutionalization and the consolidation of our democracy.
Yeah, absolutely, Prof. And what I really want to get into the nitty-gritty this evening is, there we have a powerful country. And there's a bottom line, Prof. I'm talking about the wealth that South Africa has. It has it all. And, we cannot deny it. It's one of the richest country on earth. And, we got things that, it's an envy of the world, Prof. It's an envy of the world. But what's really happening locally? And what's really happening is, many will say, no, it's outside forces that are interfering with the country. It's outside forces that are causing instability. It is all to do with outside forces. It's all about a tug of war. The Chinese are trying to pull, get their share here. The Americans are here. The British conglomerates are also here. And the Americans are here. But there's a tug of war. How can one government deal with the Chinese, the Americans, the British? The Russians, all playing a game of, we want a share of the pie. How does this government react to that? It seems like this government is giving everyone whatever they want, Prof. Talk to me about that.
Yes, Shafat, I would like to start at the point arguing that South Africa is a very rich country. And many people are telling us that this is an extremely rich country. My view on it is that in terms of potential, we are relatively somewhere in the middle. I think if we look at the at least natural potential of countries like, for example, Angola, like the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and maybe some of the other states, they have potential. I would even go as far as to say Malawi, Zambia, even Zimbabwe, their natural potential is in many ways more than that of South Africa. What made South Africa different was potential and the creativity we had in order to survive. And that is what makes South Africa the most sophisticated country in Africa for many years. But currently, we are falling back. I think we are now second or third Nigeria in terms of gross domestic product, as well as I think Egypt are ahead of South Africa. But coming to your specific question about the natural resources and the richness of our country, I am concerned that we are not always focusing on development in the sense that we must develop a country. We must rather compare us to countries like Japan and the Netherlands, who basically do not even have enough natural resources to survive. But both these countries have some of the strongest economies for their size in the world. And if you look at these countries, what are making them different? It's not the geography. It is not the minerals or the richness or the land or whatever you would like to call it. It is the human capital. And South Africa is lacking when it comes to human capital. And currently, our policies, which is very racially defined in this country, is driving away the human capital of the country. Sometimes people saying we are the biggest exporters of taxpayers in the world. And in reality, this is happening. And this is a very unfortunate scenario. Currently, we are talking about just over 3 million people paying personal taxes in a population of about 60 million. The most recent statistics about unemployment are putting the bigger figure on 47%. To put it in exact terms, just more than 14 million people are employed, but when we look at the unemployment rate, it is more than 12 million people, very close to the same figure. If we look at the crime in the country, we are comparing ourselves with the worst in the world, with countries where there's active civil war going on. We know what happened in July in KZN and parts of Gauteng. And this is reflecting on a very negative situation. We have potential. We have the resources to go on. But at the moment, we are lacking when it comes to human capital.
Yeah, absolutely, Prof. And as you said, we are lacking when it comes to human capital or human resources. You know, you're talking about the think tanks and those that have the vision, those that have the brains to run the economy of the country. And then, you know, what I'd like to get into, if you look at our demographics, so you look at the population breakup of this country, you know, you've got the majority blacks, and then you have the whites coming through, the coloreds, the Indians, and then the other smaller groups that come through the Khoi and so forth. But among these groups, Prof, you know, you notice that the white community played a very pivotal role, during apartheid and perhaps post-apartheid in running the economy of this country, running its infrastructure. And, you know, when you looked at their performance, and if you had to put a graph next to it, you could have given them a 99.9% for, you know, running it on the straight and narrow, and delivering to a level of optimum. And then you find that, you know, even when it came to the education and the scientific studies, even if you look at the research that we do on all this pandemic, you know, South Africa still has one of the best laboratories in the world for diseases and so forth. And all this was built, you know, during the time of apartheid and carried on. I'm looking at the different types of, we have to give them credit for what has been done there. And then you find the other groups. How have the different groups, you know, contributed to this country, as you said, as a human resource? Talk to us about that, Rapro.
Well, Shafat, that is a very if you analyze this on racial lines, you will receive a lot of criticism. What I think I can say about this point is that there's no doubt that in the period before 1994, the white people in the country, and to a lesser extent some of the other communities, play a pivotal role in the development of the country. And we can look at some of the biggest successes, and we can referred to, amongst others, the whole Sasol thing and the development of petrol from coal, which was a revolutionary initiative for that time. We are looking at the development of the atom bomb in South Africa during the 60s and the 70s. What happened at Eskom, to give another example, what happened to Armscor, the G5, the G6, our helicopters, our aeroplanes that we developed in isolation. So yes, we had huge successes also in terms of the mining industry. Some of the most sophisticated mining equipment in the world during that time. When we enter 1994, we enter a new government we have a new government that follow a completely different policy, basically playing what you call the blame game and argue that we need to turn around the apartheid structure and replace that with black economic empowerment. And in many institutions, not only within the state, but also within the private sector, the policy was to get rid of your experienced and well-qualified people, especially if they were white people. And the loss in human capital was huge. And I can give you so many statistics. And I'm in the world of education for the past 35 years. And I can tell you there are exceptionally good talent in the other communities outside of the white community. And here I'm referring to the so-called colored community, the Indian community, and the different black communities in South Africa. But I think the government pushed too hard in terms of the racial agenda, and we end up in a situation where we experience high levels of institutional and political decay. And if I can give one statistic to mention the crisis we are in, is that 80 to 90% of local government structures are experiencing capacity problems. So the question, did we replace white skills we had before 1994? The answer is yes. Did we with people that could really take their place in terms of capacity? Unfortunately, in most cases, this were not the scenario. The scenario was that we replace well-qualified people with complete inexperienced people, and the result is that we pay the price in so many areas of politics, of the field of the economy, producing us with a number of challenges. And at the moment, we have reached what I call a tipping point. And hopefully, we as South Africans can find each other around the challenges and build together, not of the reaction we had post 1994, but in terms of a strategic future vision. We do not have to think Karl Marx. His argument was, I am, therefore I think. So I'm arguing from my situation. If my situation is bad, I am basically arguing that it cannot be changed. I am, therefore I think. I am going the opposite way with a French philosopher. I think, therefore I am. I am creating my own destiny, and I'm taking responsibility for that. If we can entrench that value, I think we can take a huge step forward as South Africans.
You know, Prof, I'm going to Kodesa, I'm going to all these meetings that Mandela was having with F.W. de Klerk and the different parties. Well, was there an understanding amongst, the parties that, okay, we're going to get power, black power is coming through, we're going to go through an election. But, I'm sure Nelson Mandela must have thought, you know what, we do not have the expertise to this run the country at the best level. Perhaps, we need to tap into the resources of existing structures and to keep those men that know how to run the structures, and perhaps to teach our people how to run these entities or the state-owned enterprises and so forth. I mean, surely there must have been some discussion, and something went wrong somewhere, because during the leadership of Mandela, it seemed Eskom ran properly, the other state-owned enterprises and the utilities were running properly. There was no load shedding and so forth. What could you tell us about the dialogue or the discussions that took place at that time, Prof?
Well, Shafat, I think during the transitional years, and let's say the Mandela term of about 5 years, was a transitional period. At that point, we very much had a new dispensation, but to a relative large extent, a status quo in terms of the functioning of many state and non-state institutions. And the basic situation developed very positively, because at that point we received a lot of financial and economic support from the outside world. The economy was blooming. We were paying our debt. We even won the international, the Rugby World Cup, and so on. So there was a very positive mood at that point in time. We ended apartheid. We are into a new dispensation. But after the transitional period, The ANC's ideology, which we call the National Democratic Revolution, kick in. And the basis of that ideology is that all people are equal and all people should be treated equal, and the outcome also in terms of the economy, the production factors, as well as social status, should all be equal. And then the ANC government start actively to promote equity policies. And their strategy was black economic empowerment. And then they remove the people with the skills, the people with the capacity that kept the machine going under sometimes difficult circumstances. And this ended up in a type of situation, and you talk about Eskom. The problem with Eskom started under Mbeki around 1999. The strategic advisors of Eskom advise him that we're going to run into trouble with the current situation. We need to plan and develop new things. And the basic argument at that point, what is in it for the ANC? They had tapped on the arms deal, a lot of money illegally. They want a second project. They saw that with regard to Eskom. And the end result, we know it was Medupi and the Kusile, and it cost us probably 5 to 10 times more than it was originally planned, if not more than that. The structures weren't well developed. So basically, it was a failure in many ways. And I think that is the viewpoint of R.W. Johnson as well. The new dispensation failed South Africa. And at the core of that failure was rapid transformation, affirmative action, not apply in a proper way, and the thing we call cadre deployments at all levels. And hopefully, we can go to the table now again and decide which way we are going to take us forward. Because this government at the moment is in an ideological crisis. All they have is their criticism against apartheid and playing the blame game. They do not have a strategic vision and the answer to the major challenges facing South Africa on levels of politics, economy, and society.
Yeah, Prof, they're very eloquent indeed, and already taking us way back and talking to us about, during the time of Mandela, who, had the vision to see, we just can't jump into things. There is a ship running here. We need to take control of the ship very gently. I'll be the captain, but I'll still keep some of the old crew here so that, the ship can get to its destination. Now, perhaps he succeeded. And as our prof said, when Thabo Mbeki came into the picture and he asked the question, what is there in it for the ANC, which, ANC put themselves up before the country or before the people? God knows. And perhaps our prof can answer that after this. And then also we look at when the changing of the guards took place, when the changing of the police force, when others came to take the control of the police force and the army and maybe the intelligentsia and so forth, what happened then? Did an implosion take place? Were these people, really interested in learning and doing the best for the country? Or were these people already captured that came to take these strategic position and the intention was only one intention? Is that to take this country down? I don't know, but Prof will be giving us all those answers. First, we'll go for a quick break, and inshallah, we will continue with this fascinating conversation with Professor Andre Duvenard.
You're listening to Marcus Sahaba Online Radio Podcast.
Yes, sir, the program is Wasaila Elama Sadika, a fascinating conversation with our very own Professor Andre Duvenaga. Yes, sir, Prof, before the break, we made the point number one, the country, when the changing of the guards took place, number one, it was the police force that was, everyone moved out and you got the people coming in, Jackie Selebe and so forth and so forth. And then you got the army also coming through and you know, changing of the guards, and, you know, all these things coming through. And thirdly, Thabo Mbeki, you know, making pronouncements about the country. And many said, you know, I think you alluded to the fact he put forward, you know, a certain requisition of what is they in for the ANC. And it was during the reign of Thabo Mbeki that this big issue of the armaments industry story, or the, you know, buying arms from the French manufacturer came through. And many say that even that case hasn't been fully investigated, and that Thabo Mbeki virtually got away scot-free. Looking at these scenarios, how do you react, Prof?
Well, Shafat, yes, I think I must go back to a concept I used earlier to answer you, and that is the concept of the National Democratic Revolution, which is the blueprint of thinking within the ANC. And according to this revolution, there are three stages. The first one is getting political control. And that started by winning the 1994 election. And then secondly, getting control over the security institutions. That is the police, that is the military, that is the intelligence environment. And to a certain extent, correctional services as well. So that was the first step. And that was basically completed after the first term, the Mandela term, when Mbeki took final control, because he had a lot of control during the Mandela era as well. He acted in a way as the prime minister at that point in time. But when we reached the formal Thabo Mbeki era, there was a shift towards the economy. And that shift bring us into the environment of ESCOM and affirmative action and black economic empowerment presented within the framework of the African Renaissance and what was happening there. At that point in time, there was a fast-track process of affirmative action, of getting people from the black community into strategic positions. In other words, putting cadres in position. But under the Mbeki period, relatively speaking, under control, it had a 20 to a 30% impact. At that point in time, the ANC, I think in 1999 election, the ANC received 69.6 or something percent of the support, more than two-thirds of the support. But Mbeki played this very softly. He stabilized the political environment with the economic environment, a lot of social stability, although already at that time we have started seeing service delivery protests. But there was a balance. And then came the big incident of the firing of Jacob Zuma as deputy president. And people must ask in the first place, why was Jacob Zuma appointed deputy president? Why not someone else? Because he had a corrupt background already as an MEC. He had a history of the Quattro camps. He was a very, very controversial figure throughout his history in the ANC and in the political environment. But the reason is quite simple. They need a representative from the biggest black community in South Africa, and that was the Zulu community or the Zulu nation, they like to refer to. And when Mbeki fired him, the process changed towards Polokwane conference, and then the first big knock for the ANC since 1994. Jacob Zuma is winning, the establishment of COPE, Mbeki is out. And then we had the Zuma era, seeing a fast track of the process of affirmative action, basically taking us from affirmative action and black empowerment towards a position of state capture and institutional decay. It is quite interesting how the South African debt increased since about 2008, 2009, and where it was at that point in time, and where it is currently at the moment. If I remember the figures roughly, it was during 2008-09, 30% of the gross domestic product. At the moment, it is more than 80%, 80 of the gross domestic product. The last figure I have seen is something like 83-84% in that order. So we were really in trouble at that point in time.
Yes, Prof. As you said, you know, you're fast-forwarding in and you're bringing in Jacob Zuma. But, you know, I'd like you to spend a little more time on the intelligentsia, because it's also said that Jacob Zuma comes from a background of intelligentsia. And this country under Mbeki, you know, who was running the intelligentsia of this country? Were there other forces around? I mean, we know that the British spies and the American FBI, they're in every country, they're listening to you, and perhaps they put some of their lackeys into our intelligentsia that were doing the bidding on their behalf. You know, there could be cases like this happening in this country, and who's to know what really happened with our intelligentsia, because it seems, you know, even now, this country has very little intelligentsia. Your thoughts, Prof?
Well, Shafat, I would like to differentiate between intelligentsia, because this is basically the intellectuals in the country sometimes, and referring to the academics and the specialists and these type of people, and then the intelligence environment. I think where I'm going to put the focus on the intelligence environment, because yes. Zuma in no ways can qualify to be part of the intelligentsia. maybe Thabo Mbeki will aspire in that way, but Zuma was an intelligence operator. And if you go into his history, he was the head of the Quatro camp in Angola. And the Quatro camp was well known for the way they dealt with people in the most inhumane way possible. And if you read that books, you will find the fear people had for Jacob Zuma as head of that camp. So he was a very dangerous person in ways. Now, after Zuma took control, and he was at one point in time the head of intelligence in the southern African region, reporting directly to the ANC headquarters in Lusaka, and he was very much responsible for MK activities, for the smuggling of guns and other forms of ammunition, especially through Mozambique and Swaziland into South Africa and into KZN. That was his background, a very controversial background. Also close links to the Swaziland environment and the kingdom in Swaziland. But when he became president, he basically established a new intelligence environment where he put his own intelligence people in. And many of them operated separately from the official intelligence environment. And they reported directly to Jacob Zuma. And with this last incident, in September, the incidents of violence where 350 people were killed, there were strong indications, and there are currently investigations of the Human Rights Commission going on investigating the role of the military intelligence, the national intelligence, and the police intelligence in terms of their role in the violence. And they had close connections to Jacob Zuma. And you can mention the names in so many ways that there's no doubt that he created parallel structures. And the parallel structures were loyal to him. And he used the structures with the support of the state to keep himself in position and to dominate even the ANC structures. That was Jacob Zuma. And to argue that he has not yet have any influence at the moment, I will just ask the question, he should have been in jail at the moment. People's certificate is not a certificate that is above board. It is questioned by not only medical people, but also people in civil society. It ran through Arthur Fraser, one of his close connections. And at the moment, Jacob Zuma has a medical parole very similar to the parole of Shabir Sheikh. He should have been, both should have been in jail. But their influence are too strong. And it had a lot to do with the violence we experienced during July this year. So to argue that Zuma, and you can also add other people of the so-called RET group, they are not influential within the ANC, is making a huge mistake. They are influential.
Yes, Prof. You know, whilst you're talking about Jacob Zuma and his influence in the insurrection and so forth, and, you know, they're having the hearings going through with the Human Rights Commission. And also, I was thinking of Donald Trump. Do you remember his supporters storming Capitol Hill and breaking doors and windows and so forth? And, you know, it seems like even he had his people that marched for him, and it seems like Zuma had that support. But in the case of Donald Trump, what had come of that? Was he, you know, charged? Was he? I don't think anything came of it, Afra.
No, I think that investigations are still ongoing. The Americans won't stop there. They will investigate these things until the end. But only recently, I have seen a film about that very controversial child network smuggler, Epstein. And interesting how individual in power has huge influence in American society. And in a way, they are linked not to intelligence like Jacob Zuma, but to the in the United States of America. And without any doubt, Donald Trump is a very, very influential person in the United States of America. He's a billionaire. He's well connected to the high society in the United States of America, and there were people supporting him until the bitter end. And then he was also a bit of a popular type of figure who has the ability to mobilize the grassroots people, to mobilize, like an Adolf Hitler, the people that are part of the lower classes. And to the extent that the poor people, especially the blue-collar workers in the U.S., did support Donald Trump. And what we have seen, and there's still questions about the American election. I must tell you, even months down the line, people saying that that election was not what it should be into that debate. But for the first time in probably many decades, an American leader is testing the American system. So yes, there are parallels between the Donald Trump phenomenon in an American context and the Jacob Zuma phenomenon within a South African context. Although they may have different qualities, the political patterns in some ways are similar.
You know, Prof, I was amazed to hear Donald Trump talk the other day, and he said, you know, I don't drink and I don't smoke. And I was really shocked to hear that from him. He says, no, he doesn't touch it. And then, you know, you talk about this country, and, you know, many years later we look at it, and politicians and many academics academics are saying that there's no leadership in this country, and we don't have a proper leader, even amongst the youth, that can take this country forward. What's your take on that, Rob?
Well, Shafat, I have no doubt that I think throughout the world, and probably it has to do with major changes we are experiencing. We have a lack of leadership that can take us forward. And what is interesting is that it is as if the world politics is loosening up At the moment, there's a war building between the Russia and the Ukraine. There's rumors of wars going on between, or the possibility of an attack from Israel on Iran. There's problems with regard to China and Taiwan. And to lead in these circumstances is very difficult because the rules of the game has changed. And in a way, that is also applicable when it comes to the South African context. Rules has changed. The election we just had has changed the fundamental rules of the political game in South Africa, namely one party dominance from the ANC is part of our history. In future, we are going to function more and more in coalition politics. And unfortunately, we do not have strong leadership within a South African context.
Absolutely, Prof. And Dudu Zani Zuma, you look at, many were touting him to take active part in the ANC. Where will he stand? Many were saying that, Juju or Julius Malema will go back home once again. But it seems as if the different types of coalition that we have in politics or, this last municipal election, many call it unholy alliances. How do you react to that, Prof?
Well, it's interesting. In South Africa, we do not have a strong culture of cooperation, of working together with each other. In fact, we have a very much polarized political approach, making it difficult for white people to vote for a black party and black people voting for a white party, etc., etc. We are finding ourselves in an environment where identity, however defined, is playing a critical role in our decisions. And at best, we are a country of minorities. And what we are looking at the moment is that different groupings mobilizing themselves and on basis of identity, promoting their own self-interest. With regard to Dudu Zani Zuma, he is the alternative. Zuma group within the ANC would like to present for the future. On the other side, we have Julius Malema with his own support base, although it is established around 10%. But you will find that the parties that is more inclusive, like the ANC and the Democratic Alliance, they have lost support during the last elections. But the identity parties, either new or old, perform relatively well. Thinking about the IFP, thinking about the Freedom Front Plus, you can put Action South Africa within that context. You can put this colored group, the Patriotic Alliance, within that context. But the end result is a diversity, a plurality of activity, of actors that are playing a role. Now, we are entering a phase that I sometimes refer to as the new CODESA. We need to relook our situation. We need to come together to talk to each other, to rebuild, not necessarily redevelop our constitution. We have a real constitution, but the constitution is only the foundations. Now we need to build the walls, put on the roof, and we need to have consensus taking us forward into this new phase. And if we do this the right way, we can end up as a successful country. But if we fail, this may have implications for the state.
You know, Prof, whilst you're talking, and as I think about the ANC, it seems as if everything that they do is, they're thinking of how do we get the maximum tax out of our people, the fuel tax and the GST, the VAT, and all these things. They're looking at many other ways of sugar tax and so forth. And they're making billions and billions of rands over that. And, we look at the e-tolls, situation, and this is what Greta Mantashe. He went on to say, if e-tolls are scrapped, then fuel will become even more expensive. You know, what type of mind talks to you like this, Prof? You know, the situation is so dire. Talk to us, Prof.
Shafat, yes, indeed, we have a situation where this, as a government, is basically falling apart. What they are doing doesn't work. And this has reached the point where we are really in a huge political, economic, and financial crisis. And at the moment, the leadership doesn't have the answers to the problem. And they are fighting each other in such a way that there aren't consensus among the political elites within the ANC. And this is an area of concern. And now we must take into consideration, we are entering a new phase in our politics. And that new phase is a phase where we must basically reconcile with each other, come to the point where we recognize the crisis for what it is, know that we need new avenues to take South Africa forward. It's a time of reconsidering, it's a time of rethinking our position. But unfortunately, the ANC elite are still fighting in terms of for their own survival in some way or another, and their position where they benefited such a lot from the riches of South African society and what was established. But they didn't contribute, and that is part of the trouble. Now we are in a scenario where 3 million individuals are paying personal taxes. About 30 million people are paid by the state, either through social grants or through salaries within the state system. And I'm one of them in the academia. And the whole system is not sustainable anymore. And that is the trouble. That is the tipping point we have reached.
Yes, Prof. Also, we know that by the end of the year, maybe 200,000 Zimbabweans will have to go back home. And we also know that in this country, 7% of the South African labor force, is made of migrants. It's already a shocking situation, Prof. The 7% is quite a sizable number. Your take, Prof.
Yeah, well, Shafat, yes, there are a strong feeling against people from the outside, the old xenophobic tendencies. And we know what happened in Zimbabwe, and what happened in Zimbabwe was very much also what is taking place in South Africa. Framework, just thinking about the current initiatives of the ANC with regard to Article 25 of the Constitution and so on and so on. So in many ways, we have a parallel scenario to that of Zimbabwe, although under unique circumstances and conditions. But I must tell you that the problem in South Africa, that the foreigners are performing so well in South Africa, they are becoming part of the effective labor force in South Africa, while our own people are not always prepared to work in a proper way. And this is creating serious labor problems within the South African economy. But yes, we need people. We need people with work ethics. And if you go in many areas of South Africa, if you enter a restaurant in Pretoria, and I've checked this out over the past decade, the chances that the person that will serve you will be a Zimbabwean is about 90%, if not more than that. So they have positioned themselves within South African society. But now South African blacks are saying they are taking the jobs. The problem within South Africa is that we play the blame game and that our own people are not taking responsibility for themselves.
Yes, sir, Professor Andre Dubonaga, great having you on Wasayan Al-Alam Sadiqa, Truthful News. That's Arabic, a little bit of Arabic, Prof. And perhaps, you know, if you want to go to the Middle East or you want to get to go and lecture there, yeah, we'll let you do Arabic with us, Prof. And you can go and do, perhaps, you know, earn some extra petrol dollars that end there, if you're interested, Prof. Perhaps your parting words this evening?
Shafat, we are living in interesting and very dynamic times. And I am glad for the debate and all the discussions we have. As academics, we need to interact with the communities throughout South Africa and throughout the world, and it's always a privilege talking to you.
Prof, the feeling is very reciprocal. You have a blessed evening ahead. Talk to you soon, Prof, and have a good evening, Prof.